Eichel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Jacobson. This is tape number 31 in the series, entitled The Two Souls Convene, recorded live at Eichel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York.
Okay, good morning. Welcome back. Since the advertisements of Eichel Menachem, they advertise that the shiur will begin next week, next Sunday, so I won't continue today in the text, which deals with a new section. Rather, this gives us an opportunity to discuss and expound upon some fundamental, general and foundational ideas that are connected to the general theme which the Alter Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, presents to us in his classical Hasidic work, the Tanya. The Medrash in Parshas Noach tells the following story. Alexander Mygdon, Alexander the Great, Alexander from Macedonia, once went to the king of a country called Kotzi, Melech Kotzi, who lived beyond Hari HaChayshech, the mountains of darkness, as the term which the Medrash uses. And Alexander sent a shliach, an emissary, to the king, notifying him that he is on his way to him and that he should greet him, he should be him a kabbal panim. The king of Kotzi went out to greet Alexander with bread made out of gold, which was laying in a platter made out of gold. So Alexander tells him as he meets him, "Do you think I need your money? You think I traveled all the way from Greece to here for your money?" So the Melech of Kotzi, the king of Kotzi, responds. He says, "What, you didn't have what to eat in your country that you came till here? In other words, you were looking for food, that's why you came here? Of course you came for money. What other reason would you come here?" So Alexander says, the reason I came here was solely because I want to discover how you people handle cases between human beings. What is the constitution that reigns supreme in this country? So Alexander sat in one day. A human being came into the king with another man, and his complaint was as follows: "This man sold me a broken down edifice, a churva, a broken building. I paid for it and I purchased it. I found in the churva an oitzer, a hidden treasure. Now, I only paid for the edifice. I didn't pay for the treasure. So the treasure belongs to the man who sold me the edifice." The man who sold him the broken churva says, "I sold the churva and everything that's contained within it. So therefore the treasure belongs to the one who bought the churva for me." Rabbanim these days don't have these dentators, huh? And they're arguing. This one says, "It does not belong to me. I did not know I'm buying the treasure. I would have had to pay much more. I bought it only with the condition that I'm buying a churva." The other one says, "No, I sold it with the treasure. It doesn't belong to me." So the king of Kotzi turns to one of them and he says, "Do you have a little boy?" He says, "Yes." He turns to the other one. He says, do you have a little girl? He says, yes. So he says, so when they grow older, why don't we put them together, let them get engaged and get married with each other, and we'll give them the money. Beautiful. This was the verdict of the king, and they left happily, content, satisfied. Alexander of Mygdon came from Europe. He, the great conqueror, the one who established the Greek Empire, which was then the superpower of the universe, who conquered country after country. His legions reached till the Far East, till India, is sitting astonished, the Medrash says, Yoshev Tama. The Melech Katsi turns to Alexander. He sees that he's so amazed. He says, what? What is it? What are you so amazed? Have I misjudged the case? Have I issued forth an unethical, improper verdict? Why are you so astonished? So Alexander says, yes. So the Melech Katsi says, why? By you, if such a case would be presented to you, how would you handle it? What would be your verdict? He says, we would execute this person, and take the money for ourselves. That's what we would do. This maybe sounds like... Now it's contemporary. So the Melech Katsi turns to Alexander. He says, tell me, the sun rises in your domain? He says, yeah. Does the moon come up at night? He says, yeah. Does rain descend upon the soil? He says, yes. He says, do you have any domesticated animals in your domain where you live? He says, yes. He says, aha, now I understand. It is not in the merit of you human beings that the sun rises every morning and that the moon comes up at night and that rain descends to water the soil. It is rather in the merit as a consequence of the reality of the animals, of the domesticated animals that exist within you. Because as far as the human beings are concerned, they do not deserve to exist in a world where a sun rises, where a moon comes up to illuminate a dark night, where rain comes to water a world. As far as these human beings are concerned, this should not happen. It's rather in honor of the animals, the innocent animals that exist. The Medrash concludes, this is Pshat in the Pasuk, Adam in Tehillim, Adam u'behema teshia Hashem, man and animal shall you salvage Hashem, that Hashem salvages, saves, helps, and redeems the human being because of the behemoth that exists within his domain. Since this story is told in the agadic part of Torah versus the halachic part of Torah, it's very possible, as explained in various svarim concerning similar stories, that this entire episode is in essence a metaphor, a parable to express a specific idea, ideology. Even if we are to assume that the story actually happened in the concrete world, and indeed there were many researchers done attempting to discover the exact geographical place of these Hare Chayshech, these mountains of darkness, which are discussed in various places in Chazal, and the domain which is supposedly beyond these mountains of darkness. But in any case, it's obvious that the story contains a content and it has been transcribed in Torah in order to teach the person a lesson. Obviously, this episode is filled with symbols from beginning to end, which we have to probe into. We have to uncover the layers of significance that veil the content. What do you think is the content of the story? Quite enigmatic episode, huh? Was it a world of fantasy versus a world of reality? The first thing we come across, the first feature we recognize is Alexander's amazement, astonishment. He can't get over what's happening. He can't believe what his ears are hearing. And Melech Katsi is surprised that Alexander is so amazed. He says, "What is it? Have I issued forth an unethical, improper, unjustified verdict?" And Alexander says, "Yes." One of the possible explanations this episode is that here indeed we have mirrored and expressed in a very powerful and real way one of the most essential, foundational doctrines which the Alter Rebbe establishes right in the beginning of Tanya, and which serves actually as the central theme penetrating this entire book as he sketches forth a program for life. The two kings, the two emperors, Alexander Magdan and Melech Katsi, I think symbolize and embody the two kings which the Alter Rebbe discussed in the ninth chapter of Tanya, existing within the dynamic of life, existing within the body of the Jew, and constantly engaged in a perpetual battle, each one wishing and desiring to dominate and to rule over the little city which is called the life of man, the body of man. These two kings actually personify and symbolize two levels of consciousness which vary drastically in their perspectives, visions, experiences, ambitions, and drives. What is the essential difference between the two levels of consciousness on which the Jew operates? So we have A, the beastly soul, the animal soul. This is a soul defined by fragmentation and separateness, devoid of harmony and unity. Each human being contains and possesses an individual, egotistical center point from which stem many of his drives, insights, instincts, ambitions, and so forth. At the core of all of these drives is one point: conquest, mastery, power, self-expansion, self-aggrandizement, and so on. So the animal soul is the essence of physical life. Its every act is motivated by the quest for self-enhancement, self-preservation, self-gratification. Not in vain did the brilliant conceiver of this tale choose Alexander the Great as the man to symbolize and embody this dimension of the human consciousness. Alexander the Great conqueror is the man who went down in the annals of history as the greatest conqueror of all times. Because indeed, this soul, this level of consciousness, is defined by its sense of ego and self-consciousness, and its ongoing, never-ending drive to further and enhance that state of self. All of us feel and experience constantly demands in our life that are stemming from that egotistical axis, from that egotistical essence. And we behave based on these demands, even if these behavioral patterns might often be cloaked in ideological masks or even religious masks. But nevertheless, often at the core of these behavioral routines, acts, patterns, and so forth, stands the ego. That's one level of consciousness. In contrast to this soul stands another soul, the transcendental consciousness in man. This soul constitutes man's capacity for self-transcendence. This soul is a spark of divinity that gravitates to its source, striving to escape the self and be nullified within the being of Hashem. This consciousness is not defined by its sense of ego, separating it from something outside of its ego. On the contrary, when operating on this level of self and consciousness, man experiences the world and the needs of the world, of the human beings around him, just as he experiences his own needs. Just as one hand will not get into a conflict with the other hand. Did you ever see, if your left hand did something wrong, you ever see your right hand begin hating it, despising it, start contriving plans how to harm the left hand? It never happens. Why not? Why doesn't it happen? Because both hands are part of one unit, are part of one organism, part of one body. This soul is in touch with another human being as one hand is in touch with the other hand. Since the body serves both souls as their vehicle for realization, this makes life exciting. This makes for the perpetual struggle of life. The struggle between matter and spirit, between self-assertion, self-nullification, between being yes and being not. Any thought, desire, or act of man throughout the 24 hours of your day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 80, 90, 100 years and so forth, every act, word, deed, thought, desire and so forth stems from either of the two souls, depending upon which has at that moment gained mastery over the other and is asserting itself in the concrete world through his behavior. So we're in one soul. Man's identity is defined by the definition of ego, of the sense of I. By another soul, man's identity is defined not by its sense of self, but by its sense of selflessness. So there is that identity of man where we experience ourselves as a self-contained, separated identity defined by the fact that I am different than you and I stand in contrast with you, where you're ultimately an enemy or at least a potential enemy. But then man has a deeper identity, Yiddishkeit teaches, where the identity is not defined by the I, but that identity is defined by his ongoing search and yearning to be included in the all-pervading, absolute, eternal reality of Hashem. When man probes into the self beyond the initial shell, he comes to discover a selfless identity within him. And the deeper he gets into the selfless identity becomes more and more revealed. Beyond the ego of man, in other words, there is a dimension in man which seeks to transcend itself, to fly away, to soar beyond its own parameters, to connect with what's absolute, eternal, and godly in life. Two kings. These two kings represent two worlds, two visions, two perspectives on reality. One is all too often the world that we recognize so well, the reality that we come in contact with on a daily basis. The other represents perhaps a concealed world, a world that exists only beyond the mountains of darkness, a world that is relegated to the dark cellars of our society and our consciousness. A world that the king of this world is defined as Melech Katzi, Melech Katzi or Melech Katzi. The world, the king of the end. It symbolizes the utopian universe, which will, the reality, the perspective, which will fill the space of our world in the future and the world to come. The encounter between these two kings is the first encounter between these two consciousnesses, these two worlds, these two perspectives, these two souls. In the kingdom of Melech Katzi, which means in a kingdom which is governed by the rules, by the character, by the identity of the transcendental consciousness in man. You know why people come to court? You know what people are fighting about? That the other person should get the money. Does it come from naivete? What does it come from? When man operates on this level of consciousness, his identity is not defined exclusively by ego. By the fact that I should have and you should have not. And me having excludes you having. Because I am I and you are you. Identity is not defined on that level by separating the you from the I, by the fact that I feel myself in contrast to feeling and experiencing you. Here, identity is experienced by transcending that egotistical sense of self. It's finding a deeper identity where man is connected with Hashem. When Alexander of Macedonia sees that here in this place people are actually fighting about who should get, people are actually, everyone wants the other one should get the money, he can't understand it. He doesn't begin to comprehend it. He thinks either they're totally meshuga, they're totally crazy, they're matured off him, as they say, or they're simple litzanim. They're ultimate comedians and scoffers who are coming and trying, attempting to abuse, to embarrass, to laugh from the whole constitutional system reigning in the country. Alexander says, I know that the reason there's a court in the world, in my world, I know the reason we have to establish and create a concept of judges, of law, of obedience to the law, is in order to handle arguments between two people, each one claiming, Kula Shali, it's all mine. Nothing of it belongs to you. Not even a third of it belongs to you. It all belongs to me. The law, the function of the law is now to find some balanced way which will be able to create a balance between the two egotistical demands in order to allow for existence in this world between people. If not, they will swallow up each other. So the ego has to have some type of laws, because if we allow me to expand infinitely and you to expand infinitely, we'll swallow up each other. So the purpose of every law, whether it's American law, every system, a democratic system and so forth, is ultimately based on a little bit limiting the ego in some way. So I mamish can't walk into your house and take something from you. Alexander Magdan says, we would kill them and take the money for ourselves. And it's not necessarily because he's wicked. Because we do have to respect him for the fact that he came to Melech Katzi to see another perspective. But rather, perhaps, what he's saying is, we would kill him because these people are embarrassing the king. They came to embarrass the king, because it's impossible that they mean what they say. That's impossible. So they're actually coming and despising the king. They come to the king. What are you using his time for? He should get the money instead of I should get the money. The other guy says he should get the money instead of I should get the money. When Melech Katzi hears the perspective of Alexander, he is astonished no less than him. He says, does the sun rise by you? Does the moon come up? Does rain descend? When he hears that they function in a normal world, he comes to the conclusion that this could not happen as a consequence of people, of the human beings, which from his perspective are totally abnormal. Because such a world which is built on the struggle, on the battle between people with each other, and the battle within each human being with himself, such a world cannot exist by definition. Such a world leads to disintegration, it leads to corruption, it leads to self-destruction. He says, yeah, he comes to the conclusion, indeed, if the world would have been just dependent on people, it would have been destroyed long ago. But in this world, there is still one element which is unified, the element of nature. Nature lacks self-consciousness. Nature lacks an ego. Animals don't have a self-consciousness, a sense of ego. They act based on their instinctive needs. Even an animal that devours, it's not doing it because it's evil. You can't call a tiger more evil than a sheep. Instinctively, for it needs, it senses this is what it needs, and it goes ahead and acts upon that. Kitzad is indicating to Alexander Maigden, with a little bit of irony, it seems, in his voice, I'm the Meshuggah. I'm not the Meshuggah. You guys are the Meshuggah. This is how reality should be. It is your reality which is a distortion of the essence, which is a distortion of truth, which is in sheer contrast of the true identity of man and of the world. I think it's possible to say that in this Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, more than everything else, desires one thing. That we should come to discover in a real and intimate way this part of our life. We shouldn't be scared of it. We shouldn't be fearful from this dimension in ourselves. We shouldn't run away from it. We shouldn't think that this part can bring us a churban, can destroy our lives. On the contrary, as long as the human being denies this dimension of himself, he is escaping from himself. He is being disloyal to his lovely soul, whose ambition is to cultivate the spirituality of life. As long as we escape it, we're escaping our true identity. Comes the Alter Rebbe, he says, come, let's learn a little bit about it. Maybe we could live our life as an expression, as a mirror of the identity of the soul, and bring some healing into our life. The Mittler Rebbe, the son of the Alter Rebbe, who succeeded him in the leadership of Chabad after the former's passing, once said that when two Jews meet and they converse with each other about issues pertaining to spiritual healing, psychological development, and personal growth, what happens at that moment is there are two divine souls versus one animal soul, attempting to convey the power of the encounter, the unique energy of the moment. He says that when that occurs, it's two against one. I think I mentioned this to you once. Mathematically, it doesn't make sense. I have two souls, you have two souls. If we sit down with each other and we converse about spiritual, psychological growth and so forth, why is it two against one? It's two against two. Huh? What does it mean? Two divine souls against two animal souls. But the explanation is as follows. What's the explanation? Why? So why is it two divine souls against one animal soul? Should be no animal souls. You're saying because the animal soul is inactive, because you're talking about spiritual growth, which means you're going beyond the animal soul. So it should be two divine souls against nothing. But that's, of course, not the case, because the animal soul is always active. It's dafka active in those times. When do you want it to be active? When you're satiating it, then it doesn't have to be active. Huh? I went to the mechanic the other day to fix my car. So there was a guy standing there who was chain smoking. It was a large room. It didn't bother me, but he was like, there was, I saw some a lot of anxiety. So I asked him, did you ever consider ceasing to smoke? So he says, yeah, constantly. So I say, what about considering it at the present moment? He says, I am. I'm stopping to smoke. So I say, but do you have a cigarette in your mouth? He says, of course. If I wouldn't have a cigarette in my mouth, I wouldn't be able to stop smoking. So, there is, when the animal soul is being satiated, then it doesn't have to fight. The animal soul asserts itself at that moment. But why two against one? You know what the answer is? Egos don't bond with each other. Because if an ego is bond with another ego, it's not an ego anymore. The Gemara puts it in these words. Ein adam chayte v'loy loy. A person doesn't sin when he doesn't gain benefit from it. A person doesn't sin so that someone else should gain benefit. I'm not going to sin so that you should enjoy life. If I'm sinning, it's that I should enjoy life. It doesn't pay for me to sin that you should enjoy life. Why not? Because sinning comes from ego, and my ego is not uninterested in your ego. If it would be interested in your ego, it's not an ego. My ego is interested in me and not in you. That's what ego is all about. So egos never connect. Egos are always out for egos, for themselves. Whatever the motivation is, if you have to connect for your ego, that's fine, but it's not a connection. It's a deeper connection with the ego. It's manipulating, utilizing the other person. That's what an ego is all about. But the divine soul is selfless. So the energy of the egoless soul connects immediately with another human being. It connects with the rhythm of life. It connects with the melody existing in the universe. It's always in touch with reality. So the Mittler Rebbe is saying thus, when I'm sitting in my own bedroom and there's a conflict in my life between the two consciousnesses, the divine transcendental one and the animalistic egotistical one, I want to do a certain act, a certain noble act, which might shatter my ego initially. So there's a deep conflict. It's tough. It's very tough. And very often, we allow the animal soul to prevail and to assert itself through our behavior. Whether it's talking a certain way to someone, whether it's not saying something to someone, and so on and so forth, whatever it may be, everyone in their personal life. When you encounter another human being, and you don't talk about the weather, or politics. That's talk. But that's not a talk that gets in touch with the energy of the divine soul. When you talk about spiritual growth, when you try to get in tune with the honest dimensions in both of you, what happens? The animal soul are still fighting. My animal soul is fighting against my divine soul. But my animal soul doesn't care about yours. Doesn't connect. So your animal soul is fighting your divine soul, my animal soul is fighting my divine soul. But our divine souls, when we're together, a fusion is created. I don't only have the energy of my divine soul battling my egotistical soul. I also have the energy of your divine soul, which is truly, genuinely interested in my soul and my state of consciousness, as projected in this story. Where the fact that it really belongs to you bothers me, and I come to court and I say it belongs to you. It's only on this level of consciousness where I really care about the fact that money has been taken away from you. It has been given to me, but it's your money. It's your money. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to you, and therefore I want it to come to you. Ridiculous, ludicrous, crazy. So Alexander Magdin says, Melech Kazi says, you're crazy. This is reality. We just don't have to be fearful. We're scared that when we get in touch with that reality, we lose everything. We lose our identity. You don't lose your identity. You get in touch with your identity. You get in touch with an essential identity that lacks the fear, the anxiety, that lacks the perpetual perception of man as the and the world as the enemy. As a result of egotistical ambitions and so forth. So the Mittler Rebbe says, when two people come together and talk about their spiritual affairs, you'll see a unique energy. Why is it? And you can make this, you can actually attempt to implement this. When someone has a friend, a real friend, with which you don't just communicate externally, you can think out loud to that friend. And thinking out loud is dangerous, right? If everyone around the table would know the thoughts of every single other person sitting around the table, I don't know how comfortable we would be. It's a very powerful mechanism. Ein adam yudei ma shebelibo yishal chaveir, the Gemara says in Psachim. But if a person has a true friend with whom we trust, whom we can remove our defense mechanisms, when we can remove our defense mechanisms from ourselves when we encounter him, and you communicate your honest feelings about something, your real struggles, you try to get in touch with a self that should be able to heal you through talking to the other person about real problems on whatever level, but it's a level where you are seeking to connect, to heal, to recover, to grow, and so forth, you'll see there'll be a very powerful energy. It's not just the energy of the ability of being honest. That's part of it. It's the energy of two divine souls fused together.